Indeed, you are. Richard Smalley, our special guest, as we talk about his work, Supernatural. Let's get into the power of prayer when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Smalley with us. Richard, whether it's an individual or a collective group, it seems that the collective consciousness prayer, call it what you will, seems to work when it's directed. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I think there are a lot of questions that are not really terribly well answered about it, but I think one thing that's definitely going on is that the mind has an incredible amount of power, and it can control things in ways that can seem a little spooky. Moreover, mind is not confined to the physical brain, which would mean that mind is not quite as isolated and independent as one normally thinks. So if you put these two things together, you get the fact that you can use prayer to help people. And, science has shown this. I mean, there are studies on the actual benefits of prayer.
There's no question about it. We have a little prayer thing on a Friday where people pray for people who are on a list. Mm-hmm. And we get some incredible results with that. I mean, it's very, very uncanny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, the thing about it is science doesn't feel very comfortable accepting the existence of something whose mechanism they don't understand.
They can't test it.
As a matter of fact, they have tested it, the science has shown that, prayer does work. But even though they've tested it and proven it in their own framework, there's no real explanation for it. This is even apart from the fact that, modern physics is getting very, very spooky in its own right. And reality is not what our senses tell us it is. And these are scientific findings. Conventional thinking, which is, many times at least inspired by scientific thinking these days, just has trouble understanding it. I think a lot of people understand it intuitively and live it out and practice it. But, the conventional models of reality just don't want to go there yet.
Richard, if it can be used for good, prayer, can it also be used for evil?
Yeah, it would seem as if it could be. If the mind has power, its power must be, shall we say, morally neutral. That is to say, electricity can be used for nice things and not so nice things. Atomic energy can be used for nice things and not so nice
That's
things.
True.
The power of the mind can be used for nice things and not so nice things. Is this why the power of the mind was such a jealously guarded secret for so many years? Yeah, probably was. It's only been in the last couple of hundred years, and it's particularly true in the United States, people have really wanted to talk about and think about and work with mind power. That's in kind of conventional terms, but in traditional societies, people have kind of known this all along. What is a curse? A desire to use a prayer for a negative purpose. Now, this gets funny because, people will tell you this is just suggestion. The person thinks he's had a curse put on him, so he gets sick. Well, that isn't the way curses work, traditionally. Rule number one, I don't know that I should be talking about this so, you know, pragmatically, but rule number one about making a curse was always that you didn't want the person you were cursing to know that you'd made the curse. Why? Because then they would, you know, take measures to counter
that. Sure, they could repel it, right?
You're right. So that if the person doesn't know that they had a curse placed on them, you can't really be saying that it works by the power of suggestion in any kind of conventional sense. So there are mysteries there, and I would say, you know, one of these mysteries lies in the idea that mind is creative, that mind has powers of its own that far exceed what people normally want to give it credit for, and this makes us nervous. It's hard to want to accept this, if only because it's hard to want to accept the responsibility for it. You know, if your mind really does have the kind of that kind of power, what are you doing with it? Can you control it? I would say, just from, I don't know, one little experience or two here and there, that that I would go so far as to say that there is a level of the mind that can create reality. That is to say, a level of reality in which to think it is to have it happen. Now, we don't have access to this part of the mind very often. And, you know, can you imagine why? Well,
that would be dangerous.
It would be dangerous. And that's, you know, one reason the occult was held occult was that, you know, it was knowledge that was held to be potentially dangerous in the wrong hands. And particularly when you're dealing with the power of the mind and, you know, the occult tradition has different names for mental substance, you know, it's sometimes called the astral light, sometimes it's called Akasha, sometimes it's called this, and sometimes it's called that, but it's essentially thought stuff. You know, we are such things as dreams are made on, as Shakespeare said. And this mental substance, this astral light or whatever you want to call it, is a very sloppy material to work with, and it's also a very explosive material to work with. Therefore, it's a little bit like trying to make a sculpture out of nitroglycerin. Yeah, you can do it, but it's things could happen, and things usually, you know, when people start playing around with this kind of thing, you know, it's not that they discover it doesn't work. They usually discover, oh my God, it works, or you know, it not only does it work, but it really backfired, and then people, get scared and stay away from it, which is probably a reasonable thing to do.
You know, when people sometimes think, remember there was that Twilight Zone episode, you'll probably remember, It's a Good Life, with our buddy Billy Mumy, who played the part of little Anthony Fremont, who wished people into the cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is so powerful. Can it wander and do things that you can't control?
Well, I think, you know, not only can it, but I think it does. And, you know, let's go back to this idea that, you know, thought creates reality. Well, what kind of thoughts do we have most of the time? Well, they're kind of confused, messed up thoughts. They're, you know, one, if you really examine yourself in a, you know, serious, introspective way, you realize, one minute you think, want, and believe one thing, and the next minute it's quite the opposite. So our minds are confused, and our reality is confused. I mean, it makes perfect sense if you think about it. It's just that, you know, we don't really want to have the introspection to, you know, good God, you know, is my mind really that disorganized? Am I really that, so to speak, that sloppy a thinker? Kind of personally insulting, and you know, we don't want to look at it as a result.
No, we don't. You have mentioned, and you talk about the Da Vinci Code, why it was so successful. How come?
Well, the Da Vinci Code hit a nerve. Now, whether the things claimed in the Da Vinci Code are true is another question, and you know we can go into that if you like. But it is a work of fiction, so you know the author would have been you know perfectly within his rights to have made up every last single thing in it. All that said, why did it touch the kind of nerve that it did? And I think one major point about it is that it really hit people for the first time that, you know, they really hadn't been given the whole story about what happened with Christianity and what Christianity originally was and what it was supposed to be. I mean, I think, you know, there are many people who've known this, and many of these people who've known this have been scholars. But this was the first time that this really hit the public imagination. And because there's a great deal of truth in it, it made a certain amount of intuitive sense. And I think it really grabbed the public mind for that reason.
Well, maybe so. But it was popular. In, hugely popular.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it's real.
Well, I mean, you know, the whole claims in, you know, that he makes in it, again, if he made up all of it, he would be totally within his rights to do it. And he says he based it on research, which he did, because there is research that says things like that. I wouldn't, take it terribly seriously as factual history, but, because the idea that, there's really just not a lot of evidence, one way or the other, to say that Jesus and Mary and Magdalene, had children, and these children survived and, became, the royal dynasty of France. There's just not a lot of evidence for that.
It does make you wonder, though.
There are old traditions that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. I know I was talking to a British magician. I was interviewing him, 15 years ago, something like that. And he said, there is a tradition in the occult kind of world in England that says that, Jesus and Mary Magdalene did have two children. And, they came to Britain, after Jesus's crucifixion, which that is Mary Magdalene and the children.
Mm-hmm.
There are legends like that. That's definitely the case.
What do you think of people who are, hands-on healers, those kinds of people?
Some of them have amazing power. I think it's a power that everybody has.
Mm-hmm.
I think, it's a power like playing the piano.
Are they tapping into something, or is it from within?
I don't think you can make a radical distinction in quite that way, for the simple reason that the power that lies within us is also sort of tapping into the universe as a whole. We're not separate from the universe. The power, by which we live, whether you want to view that in, purely physical chemical terms, or you want to view it in spiritual terms, we're part of a greater continuum. So it does come from within, and it is at the same time tapping into something much larger. It's a skill like playing the piano in that everyone can do it, probably. There are probably people who are a lot better at it than others and who are going to be able to take it a lot further than others, just like any human talent and capacity. But I think it's real, and I think it's something that exists, at least in potential, in all of us.
You had mentioned Blavatsky earlier. Let's talk a little bit about Blavatsky.
Madame Blavatsky.
A genius in her time.
She was, in a lot of ways, she was, one of the most religious, influential figures in religion over the last couple of hundred years, because for some of the reasons that I was talking about at the very beginning of this program, where, she was really the first person. She was a Russian to back up a little bit, Madam H.P. Blavatsky was a Russian woman who lived from 1831 to 1891, and she had a an enormous passion for the paranormal, and went to huge lengths to study and seek out occult wisdom throughout the world. And traveling, she did as a woman on her own, and the mid-19th century was not no joke. And she came, she said, to have contacts with certain hidden masters, individuals who, although they were human and they existed, had powers far beyond those of normal human beings, and kept themselves hidden. They didn't want, need, or seek out publicity. And I will say this, it's another thing in my experience that why this is a good question, but the more spiritually advanced someone is, the less he or she wants publicity. The ones who are really
authentic, I think.
Authentic, you've never heard of them. They don't want you to hear about them, or me either. They work better in private. As a result, not a lot is known about them. But some of these masters, at least according to the story, contacted Blavatsky, and they had a purpose. And one of the purposes was to counteract the two kind of dominant intellectual forces of their day, which was this kind of unthinking scientific materialism on the one hand, and a very rigid and dogmatic official Christianity on the other. And the idea was to promote something that was a middle way between these, and what is sometimes called the occult, but the occult as seen as paranormal maybe in one sense, but as manifesting hidden but genuine laws of the universe. And this was one of her goals and aims, and that was at a time when things like spiritualism, the idea of communicating with the dead, through seances and so on, was kind of at its height.
Did she try to debunk anything?
Well, she had an odd view of spiritualism. And she wasn't very sympathetic to it, not because she thought it was false, but because she thought that what the spiritualists were contacting weren't really the actual spirits of the dead, but were kind of like these, what she referred to as astral shells. So the phenomena were real. They weren't, some of them are obviously fake. They're, fake table raps and all that kind of thing. And maybe a lot of them are or were faked. But she was saying that, even the genuine ones were not quite what the spiritualists were claiming they were. And so in that sense, she was, attempted to debunk some things. She also attempted to debunk, the tremendous amount of superstition that was accruing around science in those days.
Richard, hold on. I want to talk a little bit more about her. I want to talk about evil, the Ouija board, and much more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you have a moment, take a look at our television program, Beyond Belief. You get 10 days free to take a peek and look at some videos as well. Simply go to hosts at coasttocoastam.com, and then you can click the television link and sign up for it for that 10 days free and enjoy it. And as you know, on Wednesdays, we allow Coast listeners to sound off, telling us how they feel about certain things and issues. You can do that, too. Send your sound off. Make it about a minute long. Include your phone number to editorial@coasttocoastam.com. We've been doing this for, several months now.
This is Terry from Illinois, and this is my sound off. For there to be any real change, we must all stand taller than any single issue. Mankind has always fought through and overcome corruption, and oppression. One man fought through violence and hate. History remembers him as Hitler. One man fought through peace and freedom. We the people praise him as Martin Luther King Jr. One wanted death. One wanted to change ideals. My point is, one man said, stand behind me, and he failed. The other man said, stand beside me. So if we all stand hand in hand, we will find what we are looking for. All we need is the one correct person to extend their hands. This has been Terry from Illinois. This is my sound off.
And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard DeSmoley with us. Richard, now tell us about the Dice Game of Shiva.
Ah, well, that's another book of mine. And the subtitle is How Consciousness Creates the Universe. And it's a theory that's kind of worked out through a lot of my own studies in esotericism and philosophy and, just personal thought. But one thing that this book does do, which very, very, very few books on the subject do, is that it actually defines consciousness. And I define consciousness very, very simply as the capacity to relate self and other. If there's no sense of self or other, there's no consciousness. Now, this is interesting, because what it means is, well, wait a minute, who or what is conscious? Well,
and where's it developed, too? Is it the brain, or is it something outside of it?
My view is that it's this capacity to relate self and other is organic to the universe, that there's nothing that exists that doesn't possess it to some degree. And one person who seems to have agreed with me on this matter was Thomas Edison, who said in an 1890 interview, look at these chemicals and elements that interact with each other in such astonishing ways. Do you mean to say they do this without some measure of consciousness? What does that mean? Well, it means that in some kind of way, a hydrogen atom has to be able to recognize an oxygen atom, mm-hmm. and under certain circumstances react with it to create water. This doesn't mean that the hydrogen atom has like some kind of introspective consciousness like ours, but it is consciousness of a kind. And if you look at it this way, suddenly our human consciousness is suddenly not some kind of aberrant deviation in the universe that has to be explained by all sorts of improbable theories, but it's one specialized instance of a property that essentially everything that exists has. You see this in the mystical literature, it's claimed that, everything is conscious in some way or another. This also has a way of solving one of our major problems today, which is a psychological problem, which is the intense, powerful, and frankly, very depressing feeling that human beings are alone and isolated in the universe. This is saying we're not, that mind, consciousness, if you prefer, is something that's organic to everything. Our consciousness is a form of it, but it's not the only form of it. And it exists along a huge continuum, some of which we can conceive of, some of which we can't.
This consciousness, could you also call it the godlike figure?
Well, this is interesting. The way I look at it and the way I talk about it in my book is, I said consciousness is the capacity to relate self and other.
Right.
So where does God fit in with this? Well, it turns out that, again, if you believe the mystics and the religions, there's a lot of ways in which God is seen as the self. You know, the capital S self, the higher self. In Hinduism, this is called, Brahman or Atman. In I would say in esoteric Christianity, it's called the kingdom of heaven or the Christ within. So in one sense, God is self, right? But take the other thing, God is also other. We do experience God as somehow radically other. So you could say God is this kind of great source out of which this dynamic of consciousness arises, and it can be experienced both as self and as other. Is God ultimately personal? Well, probably not in the way that we conceive of a person, but because God has this infinite capacity to generate everything in the universe, it's capable of relating to us personally. Or you could say he is or she is, whatever pronoun you want to use.
And when you call the title The Dice Game of Shiva, explain that.
It has to do with a Hindu myth. And Shiva is a Hindu god, and there's a very funny story about him, I won't tell the long version of it, but Shiva has a consort, a wife, his name is Parvati, and at one point he starts to play a dice game with her, and which I gather is sort of like a version of Parcheesi.
Haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, you just don't. I just don't play Parcheesi anymore the way I used to. In any case, what happens is they sort of bet, and they're basically playing a kind of strip Parcheesi in that if they lose, whoever loses one of his attributes. And the thing about Shiva is Shiva always loses. Game he loses, and you think, well, Shiva in Hindu myth is the lord of the universe.
How could he lose, right?
But the point is, precisely because he's the lord of the universe, he can lose everything. So what? He's still the lord of the universe. What does it matter to him if he loses? And this is a metaphor for consciousness, in that consciousness. In our lives, we think we are all of these objects of consciousness that we experience, like, for example, our thoughts. We really think we are our thoughts. But wait, are we? Not really, because, you can step back and look at your thoughts, almost like a third-person observer. So since you can look at your thoughts, they must not be you. So who is this you that is, shall we say, looking out at the world? And it's not surprising that one great Hindu sage, his name was Sri Ramana Maharshi, said that just simply asking the question, who am I, if you follow it far enough back, would lead to enlightenment.
So go
on.
Well, give me your thoughts then on the formation of the universe, based on the things that you've written about.
Well, for anything to exist, as I was saying, it has to have some kind of self, sense of self or other. So an atom has to, have some, it has to be able to sort of, as it were, stake out its own place in the universe in order to exist. And you could say that, this kind of doing that, however it began, and maybe the Big Bang Theory explains it, maybe it doesn't, was where the universe took its origin. But it goes back a lot further than, just the Big Bang, because I'm saying that this is like a thing that exists, this capacity to relate self and other. This thing exists even in the unseen, invisible worlds as well as visible world.
We had talked earlier about Ouija boards and the occult.
Mm-hmm.
What causes it to work?
Well, it's a good question. I never really played with a Ouija board. I had one as I was a kid, but I was sort of obscurely afraid of it.
That's a good thing.
To got rid of it. You know, the theories are that it works through, you know, the kind of player's own consciousness. That is to say, if it actually makes contact with some kind of, you know, other entity, you know, it does it through your mind. And as a result, you know, it will make these kind of micro movements in the planchette of the board so that, you know, messages come across. And, you know, the Ouija board has produced some pretty amazing things. I mean, one of the great works of poetry, you know, of recent generations is by a poet named James Merrill. And it's called The Changing Light of Sandover. And it is a work of poetry that largely consists of things that he and his boyfriend, he was a gay man, got on the Ouija board. And it got some pretty amazing stuff and some beautiful poetry out of it. So you can do some pretty amazing things with a Ouija board, I gather, although, as I have to say, it's not from my own experience.
You don't think it's a portal?
A portal?
A portal to the other side?
Well, I think it could be. You know, the whole thing is that, in a sense, there are many things that are portals, and there are, I mean, you know, even maybe places that are portals. So in a sense, I would say that could well be the case. You know, it's going to depend a little bit on what your definition of a portal really is.
They said that they found the cave leading into hell a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a natural phenomenon because it's apparently emitting nauseous fumes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there are always... there's always that element in, you know, a lot of those ancient sites, like in Delphi, you know, the great Greek oracle, you know, there were apparently, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, but apparently, you know, there were some lithium discovered in the water in the spring there. It was considered to be a sacred and healing spring. So there's some natural, you know, occurrence as well, that the entrance to hell is, you know, there are also simply places that have, you know, an eerie power to them. And you can explain it somewhat through, you know, gases and that kind of thing. But sometimes a little more going on that we don't quite manage to get our finger on.
Richard, you know, as we approach the top of the hour, I'm going to come back with some phone calls next hour for you. Of all the things that you've investigated, and you're very conscious-oriented, is there something out there that still baffles you, that you wish you had the answer for?
I don't think I or anyone else really understands, you know, what human life is about. Why we're here in this particular form and what we're trying to accomplish. I'm familiar with a lot of the theories. I can, you know, cook up a few of my own. But I think the real truth behind it, what we're really here to do, is still fundamentally mysterious. And I suspect it's not going to be anything that... going to be able to be understood or explained in any kind of conventional sense. It may simply be something that our minds at this level, at this stage of development, can't grasp. You know, to take an example, you know, think of an ant. You know, an ant actually, you know, provides a lot of vital functions in nature. Does the ant really kind of know what's going on in nature in any sort of way? Well, no, not really. You know, is this like some conspiracy? Like nobody took the ant aside and, you know, explained to it what was going on? Well, no, not really. It's just that its mind isn't really drafted or designed to understand it in its full capacity. And I think, you know, we have one advantage over, you know, what would seem to be the other animals, in that we have enough of this sense of the mystery that we realize that our minds don't quite get it all. And we're curious about it, and we're working toward a solution. And I think, you know, all of that is good. I'm not quite sure we'll ever really understand the full picture, at least, you know, not while we're alive in human incarnation.
Why are some people more tuned in than others into the supernatural, into intuitiveness? I mean, there's no question. Some people are more tuned in. How come?
Well, you know, there are, as you know, many theories about that. Some would say it's a result of, you know, past life experience. Some would say it's, you know, just kind of a natural a thing. sometimes yeah. The result of accident. I have a Russian friend who tells me that there's a story in Russia that Rasputin, kind of the great kind of sinister genius of the last Tsar's court, apparently didn't have any paranormal powers until a peasant hit him on the head with a board for stealing a chicken. Sometimes you hear stories like that. Sometimes some little, and I'm trying to think of, oh, well, the person I'm thinking of is actually Edgar Casey.
Okay.
Remember,
he's one of the best.
Edgar Casey, was a perfectly ordinary guy until at some point in his childhood, he had, an accident where like some kind of piece of metal got lodged in his cranium. And after, it was only after that that he started to have these uncanny powers. You know, I mean, what does that mean? Well, it means sometimes these powers may be even the result of accident or apparent.
It happens to us savants, same way.
Yeah, exactly.
Something tragic, and then boom, all of a sudden they've got this newfound incredible intelligence.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think... You know, we understand the mind well enough. I don't think we understand the mind terribly well at all. You know, I think, you know, we're at a situation, I think of it in terms of, we're kind of where surgery was in like the year 1600 before they really understood how the circulation of the blood works. You know, we're at this point where, you know, we just don't understand the mind very well, and this is not anybody's fault.
Well, maybe that's why the President Obama is going to come up with $100 million to study the mind and the brain.
Well, yeah, and that's definitely one way to study it. I mean, I would like to say that I don't think the mind can totally be identified or limited to the brain. That's a big philosophical issue, you know, about which you can have hours and hours of debate.
Richard, let's talk a little bit more, and we're at the top of the hour, and we're going to come back and take some calls with you, too.